Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. You can now subscribe for direct access to all our shows online at youtube.com/uprisingwithsonali. Your subscription sustains the TV production of Uprising. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro over the weekend announced a reduction in the staff of the U.S. Embassy and new travel restrictions for Americans to Venezuela. The government also released a number of U.S. missionaries who had been detained and allowed them to return home. The moves are part of a new crisis emerging in Venezuela over the past 2 weeks, centered on government allegations of a new coup attempt labeled the Blue Coup. Authorities acting on orders of Venezuelan President Maduro arrested Caracas Mayor Antonio Ledezma in mid-February. Ledezma will face trial for conspiracy against the government and is a longtime right-wing politician and prominent member of the Venezuelan opposition, which last year mobilized thousands of people in street protests, resulting in the killing of 43 people. He's being held in the same facility as another right-wing politician arrested last year, Leopoldo Lopez, for overseeing a plan called La Salida, or the exit, to overturn the Maduro government. Maduro took over from the late Hugo Chavez, a charismatic figure who ushered in Venezuela's current socialist government. New protests in the wake of Ledezma's arrest are once more threatening to destabilize Venezuela. A 14-year-old boy named Cluivert Roa was killed after being shot with rubber bullets by government police at a demonstration in San Cristobal last week. Mainstream publications in the U.S. are reporting the news with glee, with The Economist's coverage contending that, quote, Venezuela's Bolivarian regime is lurching from authoritarianism to dictatorship. My guest is Miguel Tinker Salas. He's a professor of Latin American history and Chicano Latino studies at Pomona College in Claremont, California. He's written several books, including The Enduring Legacy, Oil Culture and Citizenship in Venezuela, and Venezuela, What Everyone Needs to Know. He co-edited Venezuela, Hugo Chavez and the Decline of an Exceptional Democracy. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for joining us, Miguel. So the New York Times last week published this editorial whose opening lines were, quote, listening to embattled President Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela ramble on for hours about an international right-wing conspiracy to oust him, it's clear that he would use any fabricated pretext to jail opposition leaders and crack down on dissent. In recent days, the government's claims have become outlandish and its repression of critics even more vicious. Miguel, was this just a fabricated conspiracy? What evidence is there that Ledezma and others were involved in a coup attempt?
We know that there has been a constant effort at destabilizing Venezuelan government and society and politics. We know that there was a historical amnesia on the part of the New York Times that celebrated the 2002 coup against Hugo Chavez. And this is a newspaper that historically has taken a very, very strident position against Venezuela. So while 43 people were killed in protests last year on both sides of the political spectrum, including police and National Guardsmen, the New York Times blames the government for these deaths, even though they occurred on both sides of the political spectrum, and yet they remain silent about the 43 students that were killed in Mexico. So again, they have a very clear position on the issue of Venezuela. So on Mexico, where there's 100,000 dead and a real humanitarian crisis, they say almost nothing. And on Venezuela, they constantly pressure Venezuela and highlight issues of Venezuela simply to mock the government. So in other words, absence of toilet paper, absence of toothpaste or condoms, or other issues are used to mock the government, when in other countries like Mexico, which are U.S. allies, people don't even have access to basic services and food. So I think we have to be clear as to what the objective of the New York Times is. Now, obviously, in the question of coups, we have evidence now, at least the government has provided evidence, that there was individuals in the military discussing. They provided evidence last week, last Thursday, of an individual in the military that now said that he was approached by others to destabilize the government and to stage a coup. Now, I would really urge the government to publicize this, to make this very transparent, so that people can actually see, and we can avoid these kind of issues about whether the government is overreacting or not.
Now, I understand that Ledezma and a number of other opposition leaders, some of whom are jailed, signed onto a public letter called a National Transition Agreement. VenezuelaAnalysis.com, which is one of the few sources that seem to be unbiased, is reporting that there's evidence that Ledezma made several calls to a U.S. number and that a cache of weapons was discovered in the party headquarters of the opposition in Caracas. I mean, that, at least on the surface, sounds pretty serious. happens?
Well, the issue here is that, as you said in the very in the introductory piece, there has been an ongoing effort. Last year, during the same exact period of time, in February and March, there was a proposal called La Salida, the exit. In a democratic society where people should abide by the democratic process, it's unbelievable that they would actually try to overthrow a democratically elected government while at the same time claiming to be Democrats and have the mantle of democracy. So in that sense, it's very problematic. This time, they shifted taxes and tactics and now call it la transición, or the transition. Imagine if tomorrow the Republicans put out a document in the U.S. that said we now have a process to go for a transition to replace Obama before there's an election now, mind you, but we're still going to adopt the mantle or proclaim the mantle of being Democrats in this process. We're going to engage in efforts at destabilizing. We're going to try to approach the military. We're going to essentially hoard products or halt production. We're going to follow the model that was applied in Chile against Salvador Allende in 1972 and 1973, yet we're going to proclaim to be Democrats. And this is the irony and the sad truth about what confronts Venezuela.
Small D Democrats, I'm assuming you meant. Earlier this year, President Obama, and let's talk about what is emerging from the U.S., President Obama unveiled his national security strategy and said Venezuela was a threat. He said that he stressed support for Venezuelan citizens living in a country where, quote, democracy is at risk. Vice President Joe Biden reportedly hosted a Caribbean energy summit last month where he met with other Latin American leaders, and Maduro is saying that Biden told these other leaders privately to isolate Venezuela. He took that as a U.S. meddling in Venezuelan affairs. All of this is also fairly incriminating, and yet President Obama and the State Department have said they have nothing to do with any kind of coup attempt.
Well, it's ironic, as you point out, that the U.S. under Bush adopted a policy of trying to isolate Venezuela much the same way. They referred to Venezuela as having a contagion that had to be isolated from the rest of the region. That is, they wanted to inoculate Latin America from Venezuela. And here we have now the Obama administration essentially continuing exactly the same policy with regards to Latin America in general and Venezuela in particular. And particularly what they are concerned about is that Venezuela, through the use of Petrocaribe and of a very direct diplomacy in the region, has displaced the U.S. in the Caribbean and in large parts of Central America. And so here's a double-edged sword they try to use. On the one hand, Venezuela has provided oil, not at discounted prices, but oil at long-term credit rates to the regions of Latin America. Therefore, they are all part of Petrocaribe, as well as part of the Union of South America, the CELAC, the Community of Latin American and South American Nations, so that they have really shifted away from dependence on the U.S., dependence on the OAS, and moved into a much more arena of inter-regional arrangements and solidarity. And that's what troubles the U.S., and in which Venezuela is playing a key role. And I think that's what really troubles Biden and also the Obama administration. And therefore, they've talked about launching a new Caribbean initiative, much the same way Reagan did previously or Bush did also. But the reality is that they really don't want to engage with the region on an equal basis. And that's the difference that Venezuela has and other countries.
So they're worried, you're saying, about the influence of Venezuela in the region. And of course, the U.S. has been trying to pick off allies and create allies in the continent and the region, Latin America in general, of course, historically. Let's talk about, I just want to quote what the State Department said in response to Maduro's claim. It released a statement, you know, some of which you could say are debatable and arguable, but one sentence in particular stood out to me. It said, the allegations made by the Venezuelan government that the United States is involved in coup plotting and destabilization are baseless and false. Fine, you can argue that. But then it goes on to say, the United States does not support political transitions by non-constitutional means. I mean, that's a flat-out lie. It's done.
Well, not only is it a flat-out lie. Again, I want to urge that suggest that they have historical amnesia. Here we have coups that go back throughout the 20th century that in which the U.S. has been involved and in which U.S. presidents have recently actually apologized for in the case of Guatemala, in the case of Chile. So that it's an irony that they want to now create again the notion that somehow they're not involved when we know for a fact that they were involved in 2002. We have an incident that's very almost hilarious. at a meeting of military attachés, a U.S. military attaché walks up to a Venezuelan general and mistakenly he mistaken the individual as someone he was having a contact with and said, "How come you haven't called me? I have the materials ready for you." He mistaken and talked to someone that was actually pro-government. Huh. And that's how come we know the information. So for them to say that they're not having been doing this is absurd. And it really goes against the historical record.
Hmm. Now, in last year, as the opposition protests became very big, the social media campaign by the opposition reached here in the United States. There were major protests in the street. And Leopoldo Lopez, one of the main opposition leaders, was arrested, remains arrested for being part of this coup attempt from last year that we talked about, La Salida. And he has organized with groups that we know directly receive funding from U.S. agencies like the National Endowment for Democracy and USAID. Is there any, those are pretty problematic groups in general for fueling coup attempts around the world and so-called transitions around the world. And do you have any sense that their involvement continues in Venezuela? I mean, the Venezuelan government would be in its right to bar groups that receive this funding if those groups have had coup attempts.
Well, this is the critical point here. People are so accustomed, it's been so naturalized that the U.S., through its various so-called democratic endowment organizations, whether the National Endowment for Democracy, the Democratic Party Endowment for Democracy, the Republican Party Endowment for Democracy, USAID, or including the AFL-CIO, which at one point was also providing funds, people would come to the right-wing rallies, the opposition rallies. They had the best sound system. The stages were already set up. Of course, they were getting funds for all this, and they have been receiving funds for all this in order to destabilize. But I want to underscore something here. In terms of the social media and the issues last year, it's really ironic that all these Hollywood types all came out to condemn Venezuela, support human rights theoretically, yet on Mexico, they've been silent. I really do think that this is really an interesting issue. Look at the last Oscars, in which last year, during that time, actors and actresses made comments about Venezuela, human rights, and yet on Mexico, they're silent. So again, it's very kind of biased notion of where democracy exists and where it doesn't and how it's constructed. But again, that's what the role of the mainstream media has been, to create that matriz de opinión, or that notion of dominant view here in terms of how Venezuela is portrayed, how it's projected, and how it's incorporated into this discourse of democracy in the U.S., when in reality, it doesn't have that function in Latin America, where it has a much different role as an advocate of regional integration and of social policy.
Let's talk about the death of the 14-year-old boy, Cluiver Toroa, who was apparently killed by rubber bullets during an opposition demonstration just days before that happened. The government had apparently passed new regulations allowing soldiers to open fire if they feel their lives are at risk during demonstrations. Now, I do understand that the police officer in question has been arrested. The government has denounced the killing and not defended it. But are you troubled, or is there, should we worry about the role of the government police in these demonstrations?
Well, I think that under no circumstance should protests be criminalized. And I think that it was a tragic accident that happened in the death of this individual. It wasn't a case in which the police was simply targeting individuals. It's important to underscore, if the military is being unleashed on the population, we would not be seeing numbers in the range of 42, 43, as we did last year. We'd be seeing it in the range of thousands, as we've seen in the case of Mexico. So I think it's a tragic incident. Protests should not be criminalized under any circumstance. The individual has been arrested. There should be transparency in his trial and in having clear policies regarding permitting protests. But also, protests cannot be used as an excuse for violence, because we know that those protests have, in fact, been used in order to destabilize the government. And examples of that is to block freeways, to block highways. Those things would not be accepted in the U.S. I always tell my students, imagine if you decided to go outside tomorrow and block the 10 freeway. You'd be arrested. But that's precisely what happens in Venezuela under the guise of being a democracy. And again, that's a double discourse that we see in how Venezuela is represented.
And last year, there were reports that were pretty well documented of right-wing protesters pulling cable wire across freeways or streets so that people riding motorcycles, many of whom were government supporters, would be hurt. And one person, I understand, was even killed by this, drove right into it, and it almost severed his head.
They did. They were decapitated. I saw. I was there in Venezuela at the time. I saw the cables myself. I have photographs of the cables. A person was decapitated in Mérida. A person was decapitated in Caracas. There was a general actually telling people, a former military general, retired, belonging to the opposition, telling people where to how to hang the wire, how high to hang the wire, so that in order to have the most effect on people with motorcycles, because they want to criminalize the poor. They want to criminalize those who ride motorcycles because they tend to be poor and support the government. I saw it with my own eyes. They also put them at the level of your ankle, so you wouldn't see them below your feet and actually trip and fall onto glass and rocks and nails.
Let's talk about Venezuela's economic issues. Obviously, plummeting oil prices have had a serious impact on economies around the world. We talked about Russia earlier in our program, but Venezuela, of course, being an oil-based economy, is certainly suffering. The government's job, of course, is that much harder. And you had mentioned earlier how the media here in the U.S. and Western media in general tend to mock the Venezuelan government. The Economist wrote, quote, crackpot economic policies have brought food shortages, soaring inflation, and rising poverty. What is the Economist talking about here? What sort of crackpot economic policies are they talking about?
Well, the crackpot economic policies is that 60% of the budget actually goes to social programs, and they would rather it to go to infrastructure in the oil company so they can produce more oil, so they can have a larger supply of oil on the world market.
And also have privately owned oil.
And privately owned, because that's the position of the opposition, is to return the oil company, PDVSA, back to private hands and not to have social programs. Undoubtedly, Venezuela is having an economic crisis. When oil was at $90 a barrel and now dropped to below 50, that has really contracted the economy. The economy depends wholly on oil. And even though they have reduced imports by something like 33%, 34%, they're still very much wholly dependent on oil and on the import of products to fulfill the increasing demand. The first thing to keep in mind is that Venezuela has seen dramatic increase in demand as the resources have now reached poorer sectors who can now consume. So there's greater and greater demand on the infrastructure to supply products to the Venezuelan population. But primarily what the economists and others are referring to in terms of crackpot economics is essentially social policy aimed at alleviating poverty. Undoubtedly, poverty has increased given the current economic crisis, and that's a tragedy that the government must address. But to suggest that somehow, because you have social programs, that's crackpot economics, I think is simply absurd. And again, let me highlight the example of what happens in a country like Mexico, where 50% of the population live in poverty and is portrayed as a model for Western development and neoliberal economics.
Miguel Tinker Salas, many in the media are also alleging that the upcoming elections in Venezuela later this year is one of the reasons why Maduro is claiming coup attempts and arresting opposition leaders so that they can't run for election. Again, The Economist, just because it really exemplifies Western media coverage, said Mr. Maduro exceeds his former boss. Chavez let rivals challenge him in a free-ish vote. Mr. Maduro locks them up. How do you respond? I'm not sure if the Economist ever really had pro-Chavez coverage.
Well, the interesting thing is that the elections are actually for the National Assembly. So right. Arresting a former mayor of Caracas is not in one way or another going to affect the impact of what essentially are local elections. And neither is an effort to say that there was a coup or not a coup is not going to affect the result of local elections. People are going to vote their interests, and their interests are going to be represented by people who defend them. And that's essentially what's going to happen here. So the very notion that by arresting Mr. Ledesma, somehow that's going to alter the effects of a National Assembly election is simply absurd.
So, Miguel, the media coverage in the U.S. on Venezuela is so biased that it just really makes me wonder. I mean, even an issue as controversial as, say, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, you see, I think, less biased coverage than you do on Venezuela. I mean, uniformly, the mainstream media, but then even things, you know, online sites that supposedly have alternative coverage, like the Daily Beast and BuzzFeed, have terribly one-sided coverage on the issue of Venezuela. Obviously, there's no agreement, they can't be a media-wide conspiracy to have anti-Venezuela coverage. but it certainly seems that way. What is keeping all of these media outlets in line?
Well, I think there's a very strong effort and a very strong posture on the part of the Venezuelan opposition. They have learned the lesson very well from the Cuban-American relationships in Miami and South Florida. So they know how to target the media. They know how to essentially help create a public opinion. And they've done that very strongly. Plus, there's other factors, I think, also. It's simply the lack of knowledge that existed about Venezuela and the U.S. Before Hugo Chavez comes to power, and I always say this, and whenever I give a talk about Venezuela, is what did you really know about Venezuela besides the fact that it had oil, the fact that it may have won some Miss Universe contest, and it had a handful of baseball players? That's all the U.S. population really knew about Venezuela. And it's ironic then, all of a sudden, from that point of departure to all of a sudden, we have dozens and dozens of experts on Venezuela, some of which have never even traveled to the country, let alone actually done work or research about the country or know its history, all of a sudden becoming experts on the country, which is really creates this precision in order to be able to manipulate public opinion. But let me suggest that there's also a difference here between how they report Bolivia and Ecuador, much in the same way. In fact, we've seen very much evidence of, when Hugo Chavez was alive, of calling Chavez, Morales, and Correa the three amigos, including Lula in there, or including Cristina Kirchner in there, or the Pirates of the Caribbean, or some other version of that. So that there's been an ongoing issue in terms of when the left takes power, somehow that rubs some people in the U.S. the wrong way, particularly in terms of the pseudo-left, the social democratic left in the U.S. I find that ironic, the coverage that they actually provided of El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Honduras when they were active guerrilla movements was actually much more balanced than it is in terms of when that left actually comes to power. So it's all right to be an insurgent force in Central America facing a dictatorship, but it's not all right to sort of alter the balance of power in the region and alter how the U.S. can actually function in the area.
Well, Miguel, setting aside for a moment the coup attempts and the U.S. media coverage and their mocking of Maduro, how do you objectively assess his presidency so far? I mean, it's tough to, follow and act like Chavez.
It's very difficult. He cannot be Chavez. Chavez was an organic leader that came out of the population, that had historical generational experience, and any effort on his part to try to imitate or be Chavez would simply be wrong. I think he faces much more difficult conditions. I think much of what he faces is in part the legacy of Hugo Chavez. There were many issues here that the Chavez government did not fully address, particularly because you had high oil prices, and that is the very nature of the dependence of the economy on oil. So that if you wanted to be very critical, you have to say that that has to be an issue that wasn't fully addressed by Chavez, although there were many efforts at trying to find alternative forms of development. There has to be greater accountability. There has to be greater transparency. They have to streamline the government. They have to really fundamentally deal with the multiple exchange rates. You can't have an exchange rate at 192 on the alternative market and then pretend that you can have it at 6. They began to address that. As I said earlier, they now have a different exchange rate. But again, all those issues, they were slow to react to all those issues in many ways because many Venezuelans consider oil to be their birthright. They can't have gasoline at 1 cent a gallon. That's simply impossible. That's a $12 billion subsidy that the government has to provide for the population. And 30% of that is going out to Colombia and to Brazil as contraband. The same thing with subsidized food products, which are subsidized to protect the Venezuelan population, but a significant amount of that is finding its way to Colombia and to Brazil, where it's sold on the free market, and therefore there's scarcities in Venezuela. So I think the government has been slow to respond to that. They really need to address the economy, and that's really the challenge that they face.
Finally, Miguel, and briefly, where do you turn to for Venezuela news when you're not traveling there yourself?
I look at newspapers in Venezuela, Últimas Noticias. I read broadly. You have to read Spanish, unfortunately,
right.
But you have to be able to read alternative papers in Venezuela and follow what the actual news is and have some historical background of the country in order to be able to make sense of it all. Because otherwise, if we simply follow what's happening here, the news, the way it's reported here, serves to mock. And it does a disservice to the North American population because they really don't understand the changes that are taking place in Latin America and why the reporting in that fashion really sort of creates a greater bifurcation and a greater lack of knowledge about the changes taking place in Latin America today.
And I find that VenezuelaAnalysis.com, Telesur English, and RT are some of the good sources in the English language media on this.
No doubt. For an English-speaking audience, I would recommend Venezuela Analysis. I would recommend Telesur in English and other sources you mentioned.
Miguel, I want to thank you so much for your wide-ranging analysis on this issue. And best of luck. We'll surely have you back on.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
My guest, Ms. Miguel Tinker Salas, is a professor of Latin American history and Chicano Latino studies at Pomona College in Claremont, California. He's written several books, including The Enduring Legacy, Oil, Culture, and Citizenship in Venezuela, Venezuela, What Everyone Needs to Know. He's also co-edited Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, and The Decline of an Exceptional Democracy. This is Uprising. Bipasha Shom is our senior producer. Anna Buss is our assistant producer. Christian Beck is our production assistant. Jennifer McMartin is our research intern. Alexander Hobbs is our technical director. Federico Garcia and Jonathan Alexander are our audio engineers. Annie Mendoza is our social media coordinator. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/uprisingwithsonali. Our website is uprisingwithsonali.com. Our theme music is by Quetzal. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising. I'll see you tomorrow.